Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The United States government has escalated the use of drone strikes in Pakistan and in Yemen since the start of the year. And now the U.S. appears to be considering the use of drone strikes in Mali, a North African country where French forces are helping the government fight Islamist militants and rebels. Overall, the Obama administration has reportedly carried out more than 300 drone strikes in the past 3.5 years, nearly 6 times as many as the Bush administration. However, drones are not without their drawbacks. Several independent studies report that hundreds of civilians have been killed alongside the targeted militants. The United Nations this week said a special investigator is launching an inquiry into the impact of civilians on drone strikes and other targeted killings. And several experts on warfare and foreign policy are questioning whether the drone strikes are, in the long run, doing more harm than good. Our guest on Global Journalist today is a strong opponent of the drone strikes. Judith Bellow is a peace activist based in New York State, and she's a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force on the Middle East. She maintains a regular blog on U.S. foreign policy, and this past fall, she traveled on an anti-drones delegation to Pakistan and Waziristan, organized by Code Pink Women for Peace. In the coming weeks, Global Journalist will hear alternative perspectives on the use of drone strikes. Judith, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you, David.
Could you, just to start out, talk about how these drones operate and how a typical strike takes place?
Sure. A drone is an aircraft that doesn't have a pilot on board. Some drones come in all sizes, from really small ones, the size of like a butterfly or a bird, mm-hmm. all the way up to the size of a fairly significant sized airplane. The largest drones, Reaper drones, are actually able to carry a heavy load of munitions. They can carry 4 Hellfire missiles and 2 500-pound bombs. So that's a lot of artillery. And the next, the sort of little brother to the Reaper is the Predator, which carries 2 Hellfire missiles. The Predators have been around for a long time, whereas the Reapers have only been around for the last 2 or 3 years. They both are also used for surveillance. However, there are drones that aren't armed at all and that are totally focused on surveillance. But the Reaper and the Predator are the drones that I'm concerned about. And I'm also concerned if you call something a surveillance drone and then you arm it. So that's my stance.
Right. How effective are these drone strikes?
Well, it depends on your perspective. As far as I can tell, and a lot of the figures are disputed, but the most reliable figures show that very few of the drone strikes have actually targeted or actually managed to strike high-level Al-Qaeda or Taliban people who actually make a difference in the war. So, and many of them strike civilians, even the ones that target actually get a high-level person, often take out a whole bunch of civilians along with them. So, for instance, there was a strike in May of 2010, and they killed an important Al-Qaeda militant. However, they also killed 3 children and 2 women.
Right.
And several other men who are labeled militants, but we really don't know who they are. They struck a house while the people were sleeping, so we don't know really for sure what the status was of all the people in the house.
Yeah, okay. And I want to talk about the civilian casualties. There are several reports on this, but the Bureau of Investigative Journalism says that between 2004 and 2013, CIA drone attacks in Pakistan killed up to 3,460 people and up to 890 of them civilians. There are other numbers out there. How much do we know about civilian casualties?
Well, I think our level of information is growing. There are a lot of problems with getting information about civilian casualties because, at least in Pakistan, no one is allowed to go into the tribal region without permission. So it's very difficult for these people to share information, the people that are actually being hit, to share information with the rest of the world. And I have a concern, actually, about that strategy anyway, because if a place is totally isolated from other people and you're just pounding it with bombs, so it seems to me there's something wrong with this picture. But in any case, of late, there's a lawyer in Pakistan now who is supporting the people who have come and complained about the civilian death and trying to help them get their message out to the world and also assisting them in having some lawsuits against the West and also against the Pakistani government for allowing this to happen.
The author of a Council on Foreign Relations report this month argues that the United States should end the so-called signature strikes, which target unidentified militants based on their behavior patterns and personal networks. The author says the U.S. should limit targeted killings to a limited number of specific terrorists with transnational ambitions, and he calls on Congress to improve its oversight of drone strikes and to continue restrictions on armed drone sales. And finally, he recommends that the United States work internationally to establish rules and norms governing the use of drones. What do you think about these recommendations?
Well, I think they're an excellent set of recommendations. I personally, as an anti-war activist, would prefer that they don't use drones to kill people in any way. However, his recommendations all make a lot of sense. And I can list a few of the reasons. The signature strike are actually called by the operators who see what they consider suspicious activity. But these are people in the United States who have never been to Pakistan or Yemen. They don't understand the culture there. They don't. So even though they can have good video coverage and they can see something is happening, I don't think they're qualified to interpret it. And so I think a lot of strikes that hit civilians are called in by these people because they just, like I say, they don't know what they're seeing. The other subject I'd like to address from the report is the subject of international law and the sale, the proliferation of drones. Right now, I think they have given permission to sell drones to like 66 countries or something. There were two numbers, 66 and 75, and I'm not quite sure how to plug them in. But Israel is selling drones to everyone under the sun. China is selling drones throughout the third world to the poorer countries who can't afford ours or aren't allowed to have them. What kind of world will we live in if anybody, anywhere, feels like they can just send a robot across the sky, which is pretty much wide open, and drop bombs on people if they don't like what they're doing? It's a very, very dangerous precedent that we're setting by using the drones outside of war zones. And we need international laws that specifically prohibit the use of weapons, any weapons, including armed drones, outside of a war zone. If you want to think about it, what if there was someone in the United States that, say, Cuba considered a terrorist, because there are people actually in the United States who have Cuba considered terrorists, and they mostly live in southern Florida. So what if Cuba were to send a drone over and say, well, this is a targeted strike. I'm just going to hit this one guy and drop a bomb on a housing complex in southern Florida. I mean, that would be a terrible thing. We wouldn't like that at all. But that's what we are doing to people in Pakistan, and they complain that the Pakistani government won't do it themselves, but the Pakistani government feels the same way, not about all of those people, but about some of those people, that we feel about some of the people in this country that Cuba considers to be terrorists. So using weapons outside of war zones where you're declared to be at war is a very bad practice.
Well, let's talk about the war zone, and I think that the Obama administration considers the frontier area of Pakistan to be part of that zone because the militants are operating out of there that go into Afghanistan and try to kill U.S. and other soldiers. So inside the war zone, the alternatives are to have boots on the ground, have soldiers come in and attack places, and sometimes that also ends up in with civilian casualties. So what do you see as a better alternative than using drones?
I think that actually, first of all, we're not at war with Pakistan, regardless of how the U.S. feels about the fact that the tribal zone is a border area. So if we're not at war with Pakistan, then no place in Pakistan should be a war zone. We surely should not have killed 3,000 or whatever people in Pakistan in the last 7 years if we're not at war with Pakistan. Furthermore, the issues in Pakistan, if you go to this place, to Waziristan, to the tribal areas, mm-hmm. We're talking about a very small area. I mean, like maybe, I don't know, the size, I looked it up today, the size of Connecticut for the whole area where the drone strikes are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just wide open countryside. There's people walking down the street with bundles on their heads. There are men driving donkey carts down the road. There are villages with, like, I don't know, maybe 100 people live there. It is unbelievable to us how sparse it is. So there are compounds. People there live in compounds. Compounds not only keep people out, they keep wild animals out, and they also keep the moisture in.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a traditional form of living there. The people who live there have lived there for generations. And if there are some criminals in that area, there must be a better way to find them than militarily. This is a job for a criminal sort of force mm-hmm. to look for, not for a military onslaught. And Pakistan is not attacking these areas because they did a few years ago, and it created a huge, huge disaster all over the country. People were up in arms. Because they were literally, I mean, what do we say about Assad? We don't like him because we think he's attacking his own people. And yet here we are demanding that if Pakistan won't attack their own people, we'll do it for them. If you want to protect, if you want to end this, you have to protect the people in Waziristan, not treat every person who lives there as if they're part of a very, very tiny, numerically tiny number of people mm-hmm. who are militants going back and forth to Afghanistan.
Let's talk about your trip to South Waziristan. What did you see there?
Well, I saw, like I say, rolling countryside, people, you know, women walking down the road, side of the road with bundles on their heads or across the fields, children playing outside the front gate of a compound. People were very happy to see us. Some people, my bus got way behind for whatever reason, and we had no security, which was causing some people to be quite traumatized. But I was looking out my window, and there were people lined up along the roads in some of these villages waiting to wave at us because they heard that the Americans were coming along with the rest of the group that was caravanning up there.
Mm-hmm.
And people were waving and greeting us. And these people, they waited an hour. I mean, I can understand people who came out for Imran Khan, and it might have nothing to do with us. But an hour later, when my bus arrived, people were still out there. They were still waiting for us. They waved. They held up peace signs. I understand this isn't everyone. These people are under a huge amount, a burden of stress, because it's not like they can just pick up and go. Where are they going to go? All they have is their land and their goats. There's tons of goats out there.
And what are the when you consider themes, what were they telling you? What are some of the key points they were making?
When we actually got to the place, to the compound where we were going to have our sort of where we were going to stand in front of people and communicate with them, people were chanting. Actually, they were chanting welcome. And they're also chanting, what do you want? Peace. When do you want it? Now. What do you want? Peace. When do you want it? Now. And they have a chant there that in Urdu that they say, stop, stop, stop the drone attacks. And you can take that same chant and you can say, stop, stop, the Taliban. It isn't about whether or not we should eradicate the Taliban. It's about what kind of a strategy would you use in a place where there's many more other people than there are Taliban. The same as when they went to, when the FBI went to attack the mafia in the cities in the United States, say in the 40s. Should they have gone and just blown up whole city blocks?
I wanted to ask you about the Waziri photographer, Noor Behram, who and what he showed you and what he does.
Noor lives in North Waziristan, and he is a journalist, and he decided to start taking pictures of the drone sites. And he specializes in taking pictures of the children. And he has 100 pictures of children killed by drone strikes, and he's documented 176 instances. Sometimes either he arrives too late, because with Muslims, they bury the dead very quickly. That's part of their belief system. So sometimes he arrives too late, and sometimes there's just nothing left to take a picture of. With drone strikes, if they hit a compound or a building, the building will, which is in that area, it's usually made out of stone or cement, will collapse on top of the people, and so they'll be killed by the collapsing building. But if the people are out in the open when the drone strikes, then there'll be nothing left at all. So he has, in any case, 100 photos of children who've been killed by drone strikes, and at some point he made his way down to Islamabad, which isn't easy because, as they say, it's difficult to get in and out of the tribal area. And he went and tried to find a gallery to show his pictures, but none would. So then he got some scaffolding, and he set up a photo show on the side of the street in a busy area of the city. Mm-hmm. And when he did that, a lawyer named Shahzad Akbar saw him there. And Shahzad is now, I think he's supporting, I don't know, 9 people or 11 people from the March 11th strike. And he's got a whole bunch of clients, though, who are families of victims of drone strikes who were not militants and who are suing both the American and Pakistani authorities. And the interesting thing, I think, is one of his clients, Karim Khan, another well-educated person from Waziristan, who his son, his only son, and his younger brother were killed in a drone strike. They are, he's the one who outed the CIA director a few years ago, and he had to leave Pakistan because there was so much hostility towards him because no one knew his name. And Karim Khan, being a journalist, went out and found his name and announced that this is the person he was going to sue, and this is why. So right. The U.S. had to replace him.
Now, there was a Pew survey that asked about the knowledge of the drone program in Pakistan and opposition to it. And it said that 56% of Pakistanis have heard something about the drone program, and 21% knew nothing about it, despite all the extensive media coverage in Pakistan and beyond. And And of those who heard of the program, 17% said that drone strikes are necessary to defend Pakistan from extremist groups, and 44% opposed the strikes. So it's not a uniform opinion about the strikes. When you were in that area, were and elsewhere in Pakistan, what did you find about people who support the strikes?
Well, there are people who support the strikes, and I would agree probably with the figure that says 17% support the strikes and think they're necessary. And most of those people are well-educated, upper-middle-class people who have never been to Waziristan because they're not allowed to go there. I met many of them, actually. Often they're activists who are trying to help people. But I don't think that they understand really what it's like to be under the drone strikes. Socially, in terms of class, they're very far removed from the people who are actually being subjected to the drone strikes. At the same time, I heard a figure at one point of 76% support the drone, oppose the drone strikes. And my sense of the people I talked to there was that that's basically true. That
yeah.
They don't understand the 40. I'm not sure how Pew interviewed people, but I'm relatively certain they didn't go up to Waziristan and interview anyone or to the area where the drone strikes are happening, because most people there don't speak English, and a lot of them don't even speak Urdu,
okay.
The main Pakistani language.
I want to get back to how this is affecting everyday life there, but before we continue our discussion, I wanted to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. Or visit our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. That's Global, JOURN. So I wanted to ask you about having these drones flying over this area of Pakistan, how it affects everyday life.
Well, from the people I spoke to, they said that it's really sort of suppressed their social life. It's made it very difficult for people because the drone strikes tend to target gatherings, especially those signature strikes that you were mentioning. So people are afraid to gather. I think we've all read newspaper articles about weddings that have been struck. The U.S. Has a policy of what they call double tap, which means that after a strike, they wait a little bit for rescuers to come and they strike again. And they said that, you know, if someone's a terrorist, their rescuer will be a terrorist, too. But unfortunately, if somebody's in a house somewhere and their next-door neighbor may want to come and rescue them, so there's a very, very low survival rate of victims of these drone strikes. The people, the children, people are afraid to send their children to school because it's a gathering place. They're afraid to basically do any of the social activities they normally do. And, in fact, they have jirgas or town meetings regularly where the tribal elders sort of, you know, process the village sort of business. And that's their justice system as well. And since there was a jirga struck about 2 years ago, they are don't often have meetings anymore either. And I can tell you that cell phones don't work there in most areas. So it's not like they can have a, conference call and make up for the lack of being able to meet. So it's had a very bad effect on their life. Also, there are many people taking antidepressants and who are extremely psychologically traumatized by having these strikes. And again, I reiterate, we're talking a place the size of Connecticut that's had 3,000 strikes in 7 or 8 years.
Now,
that's pretty terrifying.
I wanted to go back to the double tap strikes, where rescuers attending a first blast become victims of a second blast. There have been reports on that, as you say, and the UN special rapporteur Ben Emmerson, a British lawyer who's heading up this inquiry into the impact on civilians of drone strikes. He says that these double tech strikes, if it's confirmed, could constitute a war crime.
Absolutely. Completely against international. It's not only against human rights law. It's in opposition to the laws that they have around war to strike rescuers and mourners, because they've struck funerals on several occasions.
I know that defenders of drones say they minimize civilian casualties, but it seems that the list of people who have recently raised the negative impacts against the use of drones have increased. Former Obama counterterrorism advisor Michael Boyle was among them. He says that he supports General Stanley McChrystal's recent comments that the world hates drones on, quote, a visceral level, and that the use of drones perpetuates, quote, a perception of American arrogance. Would you, in your opinion, is it hurting long-term U.S. foreign policy?
I do think it is hurting long-term U.S. policy in two ways. First of all, in the fact that it makes people so angry that, there's nothing they can do. They can't fight back. They can't wave a white flag. Nothing. Just 1 minute, instantaneously, because someone makes a bad judgment and their loved ones are dead. So that's one thing, but also I think the proliferation is a terrifying thing that's happening right now, because I do believe that the United States has been sort of exempt from all the wars that have happened in the world. They send people if they want to, but sitting over here on the on this continent, we're separated from where the wars have been. But the drones actually are conceivably a way that will eventually be breached, because drones are controlled by computers. And, there's a lot of people can control them through the satellites. So far, they have not actually shown very good security with the drones. Fortunately, there's been no one who knows how to do more than track them by that lack of security.
Right. U.S. Congressman Keith Ellison, he recently questioned the drone policy overseas, and he's the only Muslim member of U.S. Congress. And last week, he wrote in the Washington Post that, quote, the heart of the problem is that our technological capability has far surpassed our policy. Do you think that that's true?
I do. I think they're playing with the technology and not looking at how it fits into the overall strategic picture. And getting back to what you said about whether or not it's killing more or less people, I think you have to look at it. You can say that less people die with drone strikes if you say the only alternative is to have a ground invasion. But in North Waziristan, a ground invasion is not an option.
Right.
We're not going to war with Pakistan.
Right.
So, well,
Judith, I think we're gonna have to leave it there. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist. Thank you, Judith, for joining us on the show and providing a fascinating perspective on this issue. Our program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Donovan Ferguson was the lead producer for this program. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.